Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and welcome. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can reach us through restaurantguysradio.com, WCTCAM.com, or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis. How are you doing today?
I am well. How are you this morning?
I'm doing great.
We're going to talk today about tipping.
Tipping.
Sensitive topic, but there have been a number of articles written about a gentleman named Jay Porter, who owns a restaurant in San Diego called The Linkery, where he forbids tipping.
Well, there are a couple places that no longer, I mean, Per Se in New York City, probably the most famous restaurant.
Per Se, French Laundry, and Charlie Trotter's place in Chicago have an 18% service charge.
Right.
And there is no tip expected, but diners are still allowed to tip beyond that, are allowed to leave additional tip. At this place, tips aren't allowed. In other words, there's an 18% service charge, but I think I got extraordinary service, and I would leave my waiter an extra $20. They don't take it. They refuse my gratuity. I got to tell you, I understand that you want to make a political point, but as your patron, I find that a little bit insulting.
Why?
Because if I want to tip the waiter, and that is common custom in practice.
Which is a traditional common custom practice, right. You're not tipping the doctor. You're tipping the waiter.
As a person who made much of my living for many years of my life by being excellent at what I do and getting great tips for it, I think, who the heck are you? You know, I just think that it's a very nice gesture to tip beyond whatever the expected tip is. And for whatever reasons I, as the diner, choose to do it, for you to scold me, in effect, and say, well, politically I have a different view than you, and we're not going to accept your tip.
Well, let's take the counterpoint.
Okay.
Let's say, you know, you're coming from this perspective, the gentleman from the Linkery's perspective, and that is that you don't believe in tipping. You know, is it okay to tip your doctor? Is it okay to tip your accountant? Is it okay to tip other people in your life?
Well, I guess, you know, that's true. And there's an old classist thing about tipping. There's an article in the Times, and I thought they put it very well. They said, tipping began as an aristocratic practice, a sprinkling of change for social inferiors who are fawning for favors. And to that extent, I see how, you know, tipping your doctor on the way out the door could be considered insulting. You know, but I think, you know, tipping my lawyer on the way out the door would be considered insulting if I left him $5. But if I wrote him a check for $10,000 at the end of the year and said Merry Christmas, or, you know, hey, thanks for a great year of lawyering for me.
And let's look at this in a different way.
I think he would take it.
If I gave him a box of chocolates and said, hey, great job taking my gallbladder out, that would be certainly acceptable.
Well, let's look at where this came from. Tipping sort of wasn't endemic to this country, and then you had tipping come over from Europe in the 1800s, and it was initially a sprinkling of change. Well, in Europe, after World War II, they sort of abandoned tipping in most places in Europe, not all. In 1943 in England, in 1955 in France, they took measures to make sure that waiters were paid more of an hourly wage, and tipping still does exist in those places, albeit it doesn't make up the lion's share of a server's wages. But I don't really have a problem with tipping, and I'll tell you what my largest issue here is. This guy feels strongly that tipping isn't right, that somehow it's condescending. I don't find that to be the case.
Obviously, I don't agree. I mean, I'm in a tipping industry. My restaurant is open because of tips that I received from customers over the years, or it wouldn't exist.
I don't see it as a form of condescension. I see it as a way that we do business here in the States. And I'll tell you, they say there's a Zagat survey out there that says 80% of American diners prefer tipping to a service charge, prefer to have that discretion to a service
charge.
I'm
certainly one of those people.
While they'll accept, you know, if you're in a party of six or more, or it's a special thing where a waiter's entire night's wages, or a large portion of them rests on your individual table, they'll take a set gratuity that's added to the check.
Mm-hmm. But again, so, there's still an opportunity to add to that if you wanted to. Frankly,
yes.
In most places, if you had a terrible time and you went to the management of that place and said, listen,
service wasn't adequate today, I'd like to leave a lesser tip. I don't know of a place that wouldn't let you reduce and include a gratuity if something was if there were a problem.
That works, and the diners prefer it. And look, we know that we have over the years a lot of friends in the industry, and folks who work in the industry prefer it as well.
There's no question about that. We see from our friends who worked in places where service charge was included, their incomes went down. Okay, we know some people who worked it per se. It worked it per se and no longer do because they could no longer afford. And very, very talented people who left what is one of the top restaurants, if not the top restaurant in the country, left it because they could no longer earn the money that they needed to make at that restaurant.
And we had on the show a long time ago, back in 2005, we had Michael Lynn, who's a Cornell professor, who was quoted in some recent articles, and he did some studies of consumer behavior that show that there's no correlation between quality of service and tip left.
I'm going to say that I don't believe him.
I don't buy it.
It's as simple as this. I don't believe him. I don't believe that's a flawed study, because I'll tell you, as the owner of a restaurant, I will tell you that, and let's face it, even in a great place, you have people who are better than others. And I will tell you that better waiters in the same place make significantly better tips than the people who aren't good waiters for a number of reasons.
The same study, let's go back to this Times article that came out just recently. There are studies as well. Now, Michael Lynn's study says that perceived quality of service has no difference in what you tip. Well, here we have in the same article, studies demonstrate that waiters can increase their tips by introducing themselves by name, by squatting alongside tables, touching diners, and drawing smiley faces on the backs of checks. Now, those are quantifiable things that we know increase the tip. Now, why isn't that considered quality? Look, I don't care. I think it's stupid if somebody draws a smiley face on anything.
I really prefer if my waiter doesn't squat next to the table.
And don't touch
as
me.
Well.
But I'm a grumpy old man. But we know now that behaviors affect tips. And what we're saying is, by this, that people have a better perception of the service when they leave, and so they leave a better tip. Something is making them write more down on the tip line or leave more on the table when the waiter does these things. Maybe these things are what make a meal better for someone, and that is better service.
Right.
There's another quote that's sort of put in dubiously in this article. We're talking about a guy named Casanelli who owns a restaurant in the same town as the no-tipping restaurant and who believes in tipping. And he says, Casanelli prided himself on earning tips. And here's a quote. He said, "I could always upsell my tables liquor and desserts," he said, using the industry term for swaying diners to order more than they normally would, driving up the bill and hence the tip. Now, that's sort of a charged way of putting that. Upselling, if done well, is not just about, is not getting people to order something that they otherwise, that they don't want. It's about presenting a restaurant's options, and very often we train our waiters to mention when they drop the dessert menu that we have a great selection of dessert wine that if the waiter didn't mention it, they might not see it. If you don't like dessert wine or you don't want dessert wine, I'm not going to have my waiter say, "And you're really stupid if you don't buy a glass
of dessert." Right, you don't want, I'm sorry, I'm sure there are restaurant owners who do want. I don't want my waiters to exert pressure on somebody to order something that they don't want. But I want my waiters to present things to my customers that they may not know we have.
Or may not think of. So, it is upselling if the waiter says, "Now that I've taken the order from everyone, would you like some garlic bread for the table?" Because we're known for our garlic bread and people really love it. And when people say, "Oh, yeah, a couple of garlic breads for the table." Well, that's good service in a number of ways. Yes, it does up the check. Yes, it does up the tip. But it also reminds the customer, sometimes I'll order and I'll sit down and everything will come to the table. I'm like, "Oh, garlic bread. I wish we had garlic bread." But
well,
now it would be too long and I'd have to wait. So that is good service.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that study has just simply got to be flawed.
Yeah, it is. You know that it is. You know that it's simply not. I mean, anybody who's listening right now knows that whether you're a good tipper or a bad tipper or somewhere in between, there is some discretion. And when things go poorly, you leave less money than when things go spectacularly well. And every recommendation that someone's given you has been perfect, or really just the server understood what you wanted, when you needed, the pace of the meal, everything, and made everything go perfectly for you. You tip more. You just do.
And look, I'm a pretty experienced diner, right? And there's a classic combination. If you go out and the foie gras is duck liver, and sometimes when you foie gras, sweet wine goes very well with it. So very often restaurants who operate on that level and on the level of stage left will have some sweet wine behind the bar. And, you know, it's not free, but it's behind the bar. And you know, I'll go out as a diner and order a bottle of red, or maybe a bottle of red and then a bottle of white and a bottle of red to follow. But if I order a foie gras as an appetizer, I won't even think. And if a waiter says to me, you know, we have some great sweet wine behind the bar, would you like a glass of Sauternes with your foie gras? Yeah, I would. And you know what? I wouldn't have thought of that. And my meal's better for it. And you're a smart waiter, and thank you very much.
And even if I would have thought of it, maybe I don't want to spend 10 minutes thumbing through the list. I want to start the conversation. I haven't seen my friends in a long time. And I'd love to take 10 seconds to have you suggest something rather than thumb through the lists of all the myriad of things you might have.
Well, and I think the whole no tipping and you're not allowed to tip beyond basic service charges is
I'm against it.
I
believe tipping leads to better service, and I know it leads to better servers, because I understand that my waiters are motivated to be great by what's going to be in their check at the end of the
partially by that, of course.
And you can't not really enjoy seeing people be happy, I think, and be a great waiter.
But
you
also
have to enjoy it.
Why people are drawn to the restaurant business, and you know, I talk to young people who are teens all the time. You can make good money in the restaurant business if you're good. Mm-hmm. And you also need to be the type of person who enjoys, at the end of the night, if I was awesome and it was great, I can see that there's more money at the end of that particular night. And if I have a night where things weren't good and I made mistakes, I can see at the end of the night that I've paid the price for that. And there's a certain instant gratification adrenaline rush that, you know, it's why restaurant shows on TV are popular. It's a certain type of person that's drawn to that. It's a very motivated type of person that's often drawn to that. And I was that type of person. And I think that's something that needs to be preserved. And there's a reason that restaurants are the largest retail employer in the United States. And most people in the United States have worked in a restaurant at one time or another. And it's great. I say preserve it.
I'm with you.
Hey, listen, we'll take a quick break. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on WCTCAM.com and RestaurantGuysRadio.com.
Hey, Francis, what's your first choice of hotel in New Jersey?
Easy question, Mark. It's the Heldrich Hotel and Conference Center.
You stay there because it's so convenient, right across the street from the restaurants, right?
I stay there because it's awesome. The rooms are elegant and stylish and comfortable. The service is slick and professional and kind. Did you know they have a swimming pool and a full-service spa?
You know you're a decadent guy, right?
I do, and that's why I stay at the Heldrich.
Well, I stay there for more practical reasons. It's right in the heart of New Brunswick, so you can walk to all the great restaurants and brew pubs and cafes and three world-class theaters. You can even catch the train to Manhattan and be there in less than an hour. And if you want to dine or have a drink in the hotel, Christopher's Restaurant and Bar is right there.
The Heldrich is also great for business. In our dining rooms, we meet a ton of people who book corporate events, meetings, and conferences there, and they're all happy. With 248 rooms, 14 suites, and over 25,000 square feet of state-of-the-art meeting and conference space, the Heldrich can do up to 450 for meetings, social events, and even great weddings.
It's only 25 minutes from Newark Airport. There's a direct train from New Brunswick and frequent shuttles. How easy is that?
To plan a meeting or book a leisurely getaway, call the Heldrich at 866-609-4700. Visit theheldrich.com or click through the link on our website. Ask for the Restaurant Guys promo or online enter promo code Catherine to get a special rate just for our listeners. That's 866-609-4700, theheldrich.com, or click the link on Restaurant Guys Radio. The promo code is Catherine. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. Of course, our guest today is Rowan Jacobson, returning to the show again about his new book. Rowan writes about food and the environment and the connections between the two. He's written for The New York Times, Newsweek, Harper's, Savour, and every other thing that matters. And his current book is Fruitless Fall, The Collapse of the Honeybee and the Coming Agricultural Crisis.
Rowan, welcome to the show.
Good to be back, guys.
Rowan, you're one of the smartest guys writing about food, and you're writing about a pretty serious thing that I don't think, while it has certainly been covered, and I think anybody who cares about food or the environment knows we have, they may not know what it's called, but it's colony collapse disorder. We've lost a third of the world's bees in the last 3 years of honeybees. That's a pretty significant drop, wouldn't you say?
It's very significant.
Our bees are in trouble, aren't they?
They are. They're in a lot of trouble. And, yeah, not just Arby's in the United States, but, yeah, as you mentioned, it seems to be around the world now.
I have to say, Rowan, I thought the whole book on honeybees.
Yeah, but like all of your books, there were.
Couldn't put
it down.
And it's a captivating read.
We should point out to our audience that this is not a book, though it is a very technical and scientific book. It's a soulful book, and you're aiming for the average reader, right? Not someone who's necessarily a professional.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I'm the average reader, so I try to make sure I write a book that I would want to read.
Well, the book is incredible and fun to read, but let's talk to our listeners about the importance of the bees and the implications. We're not just talking about making honey more expensive or unable. We're talking about the food supply in general being affected by the bees.
Right. Honey is the least of it. We've developed an entire system of agriculture that actually relies on the honeybee to take care of one very important piece of the process, which is pollination. Most of our food crops require pollen to be transferred from one flower on one individual plant to another flower on a different plant, and only then are they fertilized so that they can set fruit. And that doesn't just mean fruit, it means also nuts and seeds and a lot of the vegetables we eat that are actually fruits.
But I think that's a common problem with people thinking about the food supply or thinking about their rivers or thinking about how they fertilize their lawn. There's a disconnect between what actually happens to one thing in nature and how that might impact everything else around it.
Exactly. I mean, yeah, we tend to think that these plants that we get our food from, that we've kind of removed them from nature, but, you know, we've tweaked the system, but we're still part of that whole system.
Well, when we talk about the system, I mean, it's fascinating to me that when we talk about many species, that we understand fully how these species work, we can talk about the effects that happen and the effects that are unknown if a certain species should become challenged or a certain species should drop out. But the honeybee in particular, more than, I don't know, I don't know about any other species, but more than most species, there's a particular bottleneck of our agricultural system that goes through the honeybee. And if that bottleneck is cut off, it has an amazing effect, almost more than any other insect I can think of. Is that off base, or did I get that right?
No, I'd say definitely more than any other insect. So, yeah, we've come to rely on the honeybee more and more. There are thousands of different species of bees, as well as other insects, that pollinate plants. All plants evolved for different pollinators. But because the honeybee plays so nicely with people, we've tended to replace a lot of the other insects with the honeybee, and the honeybee can travel around in boxes, so it can be part of our, you know, semi-urban environment. And that's meant that we've kind of selected plants that would also work with the honeybee. So in doing that, we've kind of put our eggs in one basket.
Why don't you talk a little bit about propagated almonds?
Yeah, almonds are the most extreme example. Almonds are, they're basically fruit trees. They're fairly closely related to peaches, but with a peach, you've got an edible fleshy fruit with an inedible pit in the middle. And with almonds, it's the reverse. You've kind of got an inedible leathery fruit with an edible seed in the middle. So almond growers are aiming for the seed. And that means that they need to make, to be profitable, they need to make a lot of nuts on every single tree. And now pretty much the world's entire almond industry is located in northern and central California. There's about 750,000 acres devoted to almonds and nothing but almonds in those fields. It's just, you know, mile after mile.
And they grow almost all the almonds.
Yeah, for the whole world.
For the world, right.
It's been an extremely successful and lucrative business, but it's hugely dependent on honeybees because there are no insects living in these almond groves. And every acre of almond trees needs two hives of honeybees in order to get full pollination, so they'll set a full crop. And that what that means is that they need to bring those hives in from all over. So that's 1.5 million hives minimum, which is almost all the hives left in the entire United States.
So basically what happens is for a few weeks a year, we bring nearly all the honeybee hives in the United States to the almond orchards.
Exactly, and we do that because the almond farmers are willing to pay big bucks because they have to get those honeybees. that's how most beekeepers earn the biggest chunk of their living, is through almond pollination. We think of honey as what beekeepers make, but honey is really just a sideline at this point. Almond pollination is what they manage their entire business around. And it happens in February, in just as spring is hitting the Central Valley in California. So what that means is, yeah, every single hive in the country that's used commercially descends in this one area of California, which is amazing to see, but it's also a great way to mix any sort of diseases.
I was going
to
say, it sounds terribly unwise. Let's all get together and put every bee around. So if there's a mite or a disease or anything with one bee, well, let's be sure that every bee in the country is exposed to it.
Right, and that happens. But, of course, you know, like, they didn't have a choice in a way. The beekeepers, this was the only way for them to stay in business because honey prices have collapsed due to competition from places like Argentina and China.
Well, I want to talk about honey prices and funny honey in a moment or two, but let's stick with the pollination aspect for a minute. You said something that really struck me just now. You said that, you know, all of the world's almonds are produced in one place. And in order to do that, we need to bring all of the country's bees to that one place, which all sounds unwise to me to begin with, from a food security perspective as well as from just an ecological perspective. It's crazy on the face of it. But you also said, now, the reason we need to bring all the bees in is because there are no insects living in those fields that can pollinate. Is that because there are no insects native to California that can pollinate almonds trees, or is it because of the pesticides that they use in the vineyards that kill all the insects in the field?
Yeah, there's kind of no habitat in that area for insects to live in. We kind of don't think of insects as needing homes, but, you know, they all need to live somewhere. And most species of bees, which are our best pollinators, live on either underground or in little holes or in trees, in dead trees. Honeybees kind of evolved to live in dead trees, but we build them little dead trees, perfect cubes instead. So,
but,
yeah, there's just no habitat for wild insects in a monocrop anymore.
And so, but what you're saying is that, you know, before this monocrop took over and we had millions of acres of a monocrop of almond trees, would almond trees grow naturally in California, and would there be bees there naturally?
They're not indigenous to California, but they evolved. Part of the reason that so much of the almond industry is located there is because that kind of cool Mediterranean climate is perfect for almond trees. Almond trees are kind of finicky. They need cool winters, but not cold winters. And they need warm summers, but not super hot summers.
We say that a huge percentage of worldwide food production and the most interesting foods and healthful foods, you know, the grains aren't really affected by honeybees, but all of your fruits are, and many of your vegetables need honeybees to pollinate. If something were to happen to the honeybees, what would happen to the food supply in the world?
Well, it would get pretty boring. It would be a lot of oatmeal with sugar on it, maybe, but that's about it. No honey for your oatmeal, and no berries or nuts to go in your oatmeal. Well, one thing I've come to realize is that honeybees, they're responsible for pollinating about 35% of our food, about a third, but it's the really valuable third in terms of health. It's all the antioxidants and the vitamins, all the stuff that puts color on our plates.
And flavor.
Yeah, so life would get very boring. We can run through most of the berries are pollinated by honeybees. All the cucurbits, cucumbers, zucchini, squash, pumpkins, most other fruits too, apples, pears, plums, and then also, you know, even things like coffee probably owes about 50% of its pollination to wild Africanized honeybees in the tropics.
So what's happening to our honeybees? What's, you know, Francis mentioned colony collapse disorder at the beginning of the show. What's going on with the honeybees? Where are, you know, we read little snippets here and there about honeybees having issues, and, you know, they have mites, and who knows what's going on. Tell us what's going on with the honeybees.
Right. Well, that is the big question, and unfortunately there's no easy answer yet. Yet there are these mites called varroa mites, which are a parasitic type of mite that's been infecting honeybees in the United States for 20 years. And they've definitely reduced honeybee populations, but that was more of a kind of a slow, steady decline. And then about exactly 2 years ago, suddenly honeybee populations just went off a cliff with losses that we'd never seen before. And no one knows exactly what is causing that. There's a few suspects. One is a new type of pesticide called imidacloprid is the best known brand of this new type of pesticide. And it acts very differently than typical pesticides. It's a systemic, which means you put it on a seed, and then it manifests itself throughout the entire plant. And that's great for farmers because they don't have to worry about the pesticide washing off. But it's not so great for honeybees who pick up small amounts of the pesticide when they visit the plant.
Everywhere they go.
Yeah.
Well, small amount here, small amount there. Here, a small amount there, a small amount. A small amount.
Your chapter on the problems with bees overall, she's very wittily titled, Bees on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown. What you're finding, or what the research has found, is when they look into bees, they find them with all sorts of problems. You liken it to kind of a bee AIDS.
Yeah, you know, bees are kind of like us. They can deal with one or two stressors, but if they get hit with too many things, they're just going to go down eventually. So yeah, they've got pesticides. Then they have new viruses. But part of the problem is just because of globalization, basically, with so many different things and agricultural products being transported all over the place, new pests and diseases show up all the time. So they've always got new things they have to deal with there, and it turns out honeybees don't have very good immune systems, so they're not so good at handling some of that stuff. Then they've got, as we said, the pesticides, but they also have what you might call lifestyle issues, which is possibly part of this breakdown. If we picture honeybees in like Winnie the Pooh or something, right, living in a tree and foraging for flowers and making honey. But very few honeybees in the United States live that kind of life anymore. Instead, they're part of this commercial pollination enterprise where they spend half their year on the backs of flatbed trucks going around the country crop to crop and pollinating those crops. And then in between, when they're waiting for the next crop to be ready, they simply get unloaded in a lot somewhere and fed high fructose corn syrup to keep them going. And one thing researchers are finding out is that high fructose corn syrup isn't any better for honeybees than it is for us.
I've seen commercials that challenge that assumption.
That's right. There's nothing. I've seen commercials that tell me very clearly there's no evidence that high fructose corn syrup is
bad
for
you. Commercial,
is any worse for you than sugar?
And in the commercial, I'm told that by a 12-year-old, so I believe it. We'll be back in just a moment with Rowan Jacobson. His book you can find through our website, restaurantguysradio.com, is Fruitless Fall, The Collapse of the Honeybee and the Coming Agricultural Crisis. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on restaurantguysradio.com and WCTCAM.com.
One early morning, I was walking. I met a woman, started talking.
The Feluga family at the Livio Feluga Winery are masters of modern winemaking, rooted deeply in Italian tradition. Founder and patriarch Livio Feluga has been counted among the 7 most influential Italian winemakers in the last 100 years. Signore Feluga pioneered the Friuli method. It's a style of winemaking that focuses on the purity of the fruit and the expression of the soil. It's made Livio Feluga Pinot Grigio the standard bearer for high-quality artisanal Pinot Grigio. It's serious, interesting, deeply rooted wine that speaks of the very essence of Friuli, from whence it comes. But with Livio Feluga, it's not only Pinot Grigio. Feluga wines offer a world of adventurous choices. Have you ever had a wonderful Ribolla Gialla or a Picolite? Well, if you haven't, then you're missing some very special Italian wine indeed. Feluga makes red wines like Verdigo, which is Cabernet and Merlot, or Sasso, which is made with the Italian grapes Refosco and Pignolo. Start with Pinot Grigio, the way it's supposed to be, and then, through the efforts of Livio Feluga, take a tour of Friuli, glass by glass, sip by sip. Ask for Livio Feluga wines at your local wine shop, or look for them online. Tell them you heard about it on The Restaurant Guys. Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. We're talking with Rowan Jacobson, author of Fruitless Fall, The Collapse of the Honeybee and the Coming Agricultural Crisis.
Rowan, in our last segment, you mentioned that the population of honeybees has basically in the last 2 years fallen off a cliff. What does that mean exactly, that it's fallen off a cliff? What kinds of numbers are you talking about?
2 years ago, when this problem first appeared, they lost about 31% of the hives in the country
in a year,
and then bees kind of have a natural cycle where the winters are always the hard time for them, and so it's normal to lose maybe 5 or 10% of colonies over the winter, and then bees expand and make new colonies in the spring. So 2 winters ago, we lost about 31%. The bees made up some of that loss over the summer, but then last winter we lost another 37%. So they're down to below 2 million for the first time in this country since perhaps the 1700s.
So we have about a third of the bees that we had before, maybe a little more.
Yeah, I think that's probably about right. And in World War II, we had about 6 million hives, and now we're down to under 2 million. So.
One of the things I want to point out, too, you're not just talking about when something affects the bee population that we have a reduction of bees. What's happening here is an entire hive collapses. So there's really no way to rebound from a whole hive collapsing as opposed to the number of bees in a hive.
Yeah, what's going on when a whole hive collapses? They call it colony collapse disorder. The bees just fly out and never come home, and there are no bees left?
The adult bees fly out and they don't come home, and that's part of the mystery is why aren't they're not dying in the hive. And so for whatever is doing them in is either weakening them so much that they fly out to forage and can't make it back home, or it's confusing them so they
get
fly
lost.
Out to forage and get confused. Which is that imidacloprid, this pesticide we've been talking about, the way it works is it disrupts insects' nerve systems so that they become disoriented. And that's part of the reason that it was an early culprit was because it kind of fit the description of what was going on. So,
and bees are really good at finding their way home. That's one of the things that they're better at than you know almost anything else in the world.
Yeah, they navigate by the sun and they communicate. They'll communicate the positions of flowers that they find to other bees in the hive by the angle of the sun and some other landmarks. So they're incredibly smart. They have a whole social intelligence. So when you think of a colony of bees, it's kind of the equivalent of a town, right? So when you think about the things that can make a colony collapse, it's kind of like what makes a town collapse, you know? If you can't get enough food or if nobody's taking care of the children anymore, these are all things that people think are going on in these hives, that they're losing some of their social function.
So what's being done about this? Are we paying appropriate attention? Are government agencies paying appropriate attention? What's happening? Or are we just hurtling toward disaster?
You know, when this first hit the American public's conscience, Congress called a bunch of conferences and held some meetings and declared that this was really important and they should take care of it. But then a few million dollars ended up being allocated to honeybee research in the latest farm bill. And that's about it. So they did something, but, you know, a few million dollars doesn't take you very far.
Well, a few million dollars, it puts $1 trillion of industry. Never mind we want to feed people good food. But it just seems like, there's a tremendous amount of resources.
Somebody's not thinking.
Yeah. And, you know, the almond growers are actually, they've been the best about funding honeybee research because they seem to be the only ones with enough foresight to realize that it's a good investment.
But
now I just want to ask a question, Ron. Is there any information about other kinds of bees being able to replace the honeybees if they were to disappear completely?
You know, that's a great question. That is starting to happen, and we're really behind the ball on that. But now we're trying to make up for lost time. Bumblebees have been used for pollination for a long time for tomatoes because honeybees never figured out how to pollinate tomatoes, but bumblebees do know how to do it. So, and it's now that most tomatoes are grown in greenhouses, or a lot of them are, there's this whole funny network of bumblebee pollination where you order a little cardboard box full of bumblebees and you let it loose in your greenhouse and they just go through and pollinate all the tomatoes.
Well, and what happens to bumblebees? They don't stay in hives like honeybees stay in hives?
They have little underground nests in grass or usually in little grass tufts or just barely underground in the soil, and they live in small colonies of maybe 100 instead of 40,000 for honeybees.
So when you get the bumblebee, you release the bumblebee into your greenhouse, and then it sort of goes its own way.
Yeah, or they set up shop somewhere in the greenhouse.
Right, but it's not. I mean, you're not then shipping them or recapturing them and shipping them around the country.
Right. Once they're released, that's they're on their own.
So it's kind of like.
But also, there's a bee called the blue orchard bee.
Uh-huh.
That's a very good apple pollinator. That's being used in Washington State, and I think the USDA is starting to experiment more with that. And there's a few different bees out there that look promising, but none of them come in these huge colonies, so they don't quite bring the firepower that honeybees.
Right. One of the advantages of the honeybee was that they live in many of them live in a very small area and an easily transportable area.
So, Rowan, what's your prescription for a healthy way to deal with this issue? If you were the honeybee czar, if you were the bee czar of the country, what do you think are wise policies that we should pursue?
Well, you know, I think we've been talking about monocrops, and this whole movement toward a monocrop industrial petrochemical intensive style of agriculture is, for numerous reasons, this being one of them, is probably the wrong direction to be heading in. So I think that it's vital that we pull back toward a model more like what we had for most of the history of this country, which is smaller farms that border on natural areas, which can provide pollination as well as other ecological services, and that we get off the chemical-intensive bandwagon.
But, Rowan, that might make the food a little more expensive, and it will make it very hard for a few people to get very, very wealthy. How do you address that issue?
I feel bad for that. But you're absolutely right about the price issue. That I think any way we look at it, food is going to be getting more expensive. And it's
well, and you know what? You know when food's going to get really expensive?
When
there are no bees.
When there are no bees, it gets really, really expensive.
So it was pretty cheap for a while, but then, you know, your blueberry is going to be $1.50, and there's going to be a real problem. Aren't there places that do hand pollination, very labor-intensive hand pollination?
Right. Well, that's the other option, is we let the bees die, and we just go and pollinate every flower. That's actually being done in places in China where they've killed other honeybees, but fortunately, China has lots of cheap labor, right? So there's...
Yeah, and you don't get to say, no, I quit, I don't want to do this.
Exactly. You don't have many, many choices. So you climb up into the tree when they tell you to, and with your little feather duster, and you go from flower to flower, pollinating them all by hand.
Mom would be so proud. What do you do for a living? I'm a bee.
Right. That's what they call human bees over there.
Oh, do they really?
Yeah.
Oh, man. Well, you know, the book is wonderful. I want to talk about one last issue. Honey, while it's not by no means the most important things bees do, the powers of honey are amazing and probably underutilized, and a lot that's as yet undiscovered, and it's also delicious in tea. But you talk about some of the honey that's on the market is funny honey, right?
Yeah, if you find it in a jar, it's probably honey. But if it's on an ingredient list in a packaged food, then chances are it's not U.S. honey. It came from overseas and quite possibly from China. And there are some weird things being done with honey.
Are they putting melamine in our honey?
Well, probably, yeah. Their antibiotics have been found in a lot of Chinese honey.
Really?
As have pesticides. And so why wouldn't melamine be in there?
So,
but some of it is, as you say, it's funny honey. It's not even honey. There's companies that have figured out how to take rice syrup or corn syrup, which is a whole lot cheaper than honey,
mm-hmm.
and treat it with enzymes so that it takes on the chemical constituency of honey. And so then it can be sold as honey.
Wow. Can it legally be sold as honey, or is
it
snuck in?
No, not legally.
Yeah, well.
If a lot of honey that's being imported into the country, and most honey eaten in this country is imported, I personally would stay away from it unless I knew more about it. So,
well,
you know, all the more reason to go visit your local beekeeper.
And the health benefits of honey have been widely touted and like I said, not even completely explored.
But this is something that I think we're going to see a lot of in coming years. There's sort of this wave building of research going on into the health benefits of honey, and some of it's amazing stuff. Honey's actually starting to look like a pretty good weight loss aid, believe it or not, which seems completely counterintuitive.
Wouldn't it be ironic?
Well, if you compare it to high fructose corn syrup, which we would never do because clearly we'd be sued if we did.
Right, exactly.
But you know, it's clearly better for you than high fructose corn syrup.
Yeah.
Well,
it's a better cough suppressant than Robitussin. It's got amazing number of uses.
Yeah, one of my favorites is, and again, I have no proof to this, but you know, one of the stories that I've heard told is that using local honey is great for people who have local allergies.
I've heard that a lot too.
And you know, but somebody's gonna have, but you can't make a ton of money giving honey for allergies. You certainly can't make as much as you can for over-the-counter prescription drugs.
Right, it's hard to patent honey.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I think it would be incredibly ironic if we just started to really plumb in Western medicine the
I get it, plumb
health benefits of honey as we're losing the honeybees. And I want to point out, you should pick up this book. And if this is an issue that is not getting enough attention, and if you want to write to your congressmen or people in the federal government, you know, we have a third of the honeybees that we had just 5 years ago. You know, we lose half as many as we lost. That's it. Game over. And what do you think of the chances of it actually happening? Do you think that we could actually lose the honeybees?
You know, I think boom and bust cycles are kind of nature's way of dealing with a problem, with some new disruption.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at it from a wide angle, I think honeybees are just crashing and eliminating all their problems. So I don't think they would die out, but I think you'll get very small, more resilient populations that can then rebuild a different type of honeybee stock. So that's probably fine for the honeybee in the long run, but it doesn't help us out in the meantime.
Rowan, before we let you go, I want to just ask you one more question about, there are some farmers out there who are doing things a little differently and coming up with some, I guess we'll call them mite or disease-resistant bees. What's happening out there?
Well, you know, part of the problem that bees have had is this mite that we mentioned, the Varroa mite, that it's now in pretty much every hive in the country. And it's very hard to treat because it's a mite, it's like an insect, and it's on another insect. So anything you dump into the hive to try to kill the mite has a pretty good chance to kill the bee. But that's what a lot of beekeepers do, is they use these pesticides in the hive to try to kill the mites. But that's obviously not a real great option. Some beekeepers have done is to start letting the bees solve their own problems. Rather than dumping things in the hive to kill the mites, they let the bees die, except for a few who had a natural resistance to the mites, and then those would reproduce and create lines of mite-resistant bees. And that's starting to pay off now. And that kind of goes back to what we were saying a little while ago. I think letting the bees solve their own problems as much as possible is the way to go.
Darwinism at its best.
Exactly.
Rowan, thanks for coming on the show. The book is tremendous. We will recommend it to our listeners.
Thanks very much.
Thanks, Rowan.
Rowan Jacobson's book is Fruitless Fall, The Collapse of the Honeybee and the Coming Agricultural Crisis. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. We'll be back in just a moment. WCTCAM.com and RestaurantGuysRadio.com. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. Hi, honey.
Awful. There is a flavor out there. Haagen-Dazs has created or actually brought back their honey vanilla.
That's so good.
They did an old flavor years ago. There was a flavor they had called honey vanilla, and it was my favorite ice cream ever anywhere that I've ever had. And it was just this a honey flavored vanilla ice cream. And they've recently brought back vanilla honeybee, and they're donating, I believe, part of the profits to honeybee research and to saving the honeybees. And it's one of the few areas of kind of mainstream that's noticed that, hey, there's a problem with the honeybee population. And they've recreated and brought back this flavor, except they've renamed it vanilla honeybee. And it is almost as delicious as the way I remember it. But vanilla ice cream and honey is one of the great combinations, delicious combinations in the world.
Well, and those of you who've listened to our show before know that Mark and I are very much into flora-specific honey, which, mm-hmm. which are honeys that pollinate one flower or another, as opposed to, you know, wildflower honey, which is just general honey where you have a beehive and you let it, you know, the bees get the pollen from wherever and get the nectar from wherever. And different flora-specific honey has different characteristics and different flavors and different colors. So buckwheat honey, for example, is a honey that's very bitter. A lot of people don't like to use it, but it's great as an ingredient. It mm-hmm. works well. And if you want to use these things in cocktails, what you need to do, because, see, most honeys will solidify when you put them in a cold cocktail and chill them. But what you can do is you can make a honey syrup, mm-hmm. which is basically, for most honeys, it'll work 2/3 honey, 1/3 water, and you use that to flavor or sweeten your cocktail. It works really well, especially with scotch-based cocktails.
Support the bees. Use honey.
Did you notice, by the way, that Mark, when looking at the use of honey, looks to vanilla ice cream and I look to scotch whiskey? I think that just about says it all.
Says a lot about each of us, that's for sure.
Anyway, I hope you've enjoyed the Honey Show with the Restaurant Guys. We certainly have. Tune in again. We'll see you real soon. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys on restaurantguysradio.com or WCTCAM.com. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys.
Central Jersey.